listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. The new edition of this Michigan notable book includes a new introduction and stories from interviews with two additional survivors, Myrna Gates Coulter and Ralph Witchell, which took place after the first edition was published in 2009. On May 18, 1927, the small town of Bath, Michigan was forever changed when Andrew Kehoe set off a cache of explosives concealed in the basement of the local school. 38 children and 6 adults were dead, among them Kehoe, who had literally blown himself to bits by setting off a dynamite charge in his car. The next day on Kehoe's farm, what was left of his wife burned beyond recognition after Kehoe set his property and buildings ablaze, was found tied to a handcart, her skull crushed. With seemingly endless stories of school violence and suicide bombers filling today's headlines, Bath Massacre serves as a reminder that terrorism and large-scale murder are nothing new. The book that we're featuring this evening is Bath Massacre, New Edition, America's First School Bombing, with my special guest, journalist and author, Arnie Bernstein. Welcome back to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Arnie Bernstein.
Thank you for having me back.
Thank you so much. And congratulations on this new edition, and always timely.
Oh yeah.
Considering all the school shootings and mass shootings at schools.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the as you do in the introduction. You had originally in your 2009 release of this book, Bath Massacre, you had 4. Of the survivors that you were able to interview for the book.
Right.
In this new edition, tell us about what is in the new edition.
Well, after the original came out, I was contacted by a couple of other survivors, Ralph Witchell, who at the time lived in Nebraska, and Myrna Gates Coulter, she was Myrna Gates when she was at school, who lived in Windsor, Canada. They both have since passed. She lived to, I think, 101, and he lived to 93, and which I find interesting because a lot of the survivors lived to ripe old ages, too. Josephine Cushman lived to 100. A few others. In fact, there's another one, Irene Dunham. There's another Irene Dunham, who is just turned 114, believe it or not. She's
wow.
One of the oldest people in the world.
Wow.
Absolute delight, too. But in any event, both Myrna and Ralph contacted me independently of each other. And I interviewed them just for the record, you know, just so that we would have their stories on the record. And I gave the CDs of those interviews to the Bath School Museum for their archives. And I always had in the back of my mind that someday I would return to the book. And the time was ripe. And I took the material I got from them, which was considerable, and it gave shade to some of the stories. It filled out some of the stories that I had, and it also gave me new stories, new elements that I think really deepened the book and gives a larger picture of what happened on that terrible day.
You include early on in the book a horrible moment, as you mentioned, or a horrible week. December 14th, 2012, the Newton,
yes.
Connecticut, Sandy Hook Elementary School. What happened in regards to Bath Massacre, this book, and the 2012 Newton, Connecticut, Sandy Hook shooting?
That was a day. One of the first things I did actually was call a friend of mine in Bath, who's one of the museum committee members. And I said, this looks really bad. This looks really bad, and this looks really a lot like Bath. And I thought, so after the, you know, the oh my God horror moment, realizing that was happened. I thought, I think I'm going to be busy, which is unfortunately what happened. I got a lot of calls that week from radio stations and TV that wanted me on to talk about it. But what really hit home, I had a friend in Connecticut who was a minister, and I emailed her. I said, do you know what's going on? I didn't know where she was in relation to it. And she said, yeah, I live 5 miles from there. I've been ministering to some of the families, and I was in a firehouse when they told them that their kids weren't coming home.
Wow.
And it was like one of those moments where you just, like I said in the new introduction, you know, God doesn't roll dice with the universe, as Einstein said. For some reason, I was the fulcrum of these two terrible, terrible things. And so I talked to my friends in Bath. I said, look, you guys know better than anyone how this feels. Maybe you can send a letter to the people in Newtown. And they wrote a beautiful letter and sent it, you know, via my friend. And it was published actually in the local Newton paper. And my friend wrote a letter back on behalf of Newton, you know, just saying, thank you, thank you, thank you. And it was profound. There was, now every spring in May, actually at the Saturday closest to the commemoration of the bombing, they have a luncheon from, it's called the school reunion luncheon, and they honor the 50th graduating class, you know, at the luncheon. At that year, Sandy Hook was weighing on everybody's mind, and every speaker who got up said something about Sandy Hook, myself included. And the two letters were read, and there were survivors too in the audience too. And it was a moment. I mean, there was not a dry eye in the house, as the cliche goes, but it was one of the most moving moments of my life. That I was honored to be a part of. It was my, you know, I, it's one of those moments where you wonder, you realize there's some, you know, sometimes you realize, you know, I don't want to get all ethereal or anything, but sometimes you wonder why you're here. And I think that was one of those moments where I realized maybe this was my purpose, was to connect these two communities. It was a day. And it was, and there's so many, I don't want to get too far off Sandy Hook and Bath, but there were a lot of similarities, mostly that they lost a whole generation of children.
You also talk about a brave teacher in both stories.
Yes.
And in the Bath story, a new teacher, Hazel right. Weatherby. And she was a new teacher, and heroically, she was found up to her waist in bricks with the two children beside her. Before we get into you spoke to Josephine Cushman Vale. You interviewed her. She was in her mid-90s.
Right.
At the time, she was 14, and her brother that was killed was 7 years old.
Right.
And you say she recalled everything with grisly detail and two interviews with her. Let's get to, of course, the event, May 18th, 1927. But let's, as you do once again, let's get to somehow trying to find out the why, because in this book, you really do have the complete story of who this person was and really their development and what really happened to create this Bath Massacre. Talk about him growing up, his father, and his early interests.
Well, Andrew Kehoe, he's an enigma. He has a very, you know, a normal life, as it were. The why, I'll get to that in a minute, such that I can. He, I believe it's Tecumseh, don't remember offhand, but he grew up there. He was something of a boy genius with electricity. He was always creating these little gadgets and things. You know, participated in the school plays, things like that. Regular guy. Then he went to Michigan State College, now Michigan State University in Lansing, studied electricity, which at the time in the late 1800s, the early 1900s, was relatively new, learning how to study that. At the time, he met a woman named Nellie Price, and then he went out to further his studies, further his education in electricity at a school in St. Louis. Now, at some point, we don't know exactly what happened, but he got zapped and fell and was in a coma for 2 weeks. Did this affect him? Who can tell? It could have, it may not have. There's just no way to know. Eventually, he recovered. He worked his way around the Midwest, worked as a power linesman in Iowa for a while, and then moved back to Michigan. And his mother had died. And his father, who was an older man, had remarried. And his new wife, Fran, was actually a couple of years older than Andrew, old enough to be a sister.
Right.
Not uncommon for the time, but Andrew deeply resented this. And in fact, they had a little girl who was his half-sister. Now, his father at that point was older and needed the help of a couple of canes to get around the house. And one day, Fran Kehoe, and again, she and Andrew had a contentious relationship.
Right.
She was going to light the oven. It was a gas stove. One count says it was operated by gasoline. Another says oil. Either way, it was petroleum-based.
Mm-hmm.
And she lit the stove to turn it on, and a whoosh of flame came out, and she was engulfed in flame. He was in the kitchen, and he threw water on her. Now, you don't throw in a petroleum fire. You don't throw water because petroleum spreads the fire. You throw flour, baking powder, something like that to quell the fire. Well, this only made the situation worse, and they managed to get her into a bed. She was just horribly burned and in absolute agony. He and his little sister went next door. They didn't have a phone, the Kehoe family. So he went next door and knocked on the door and said, could I use your phone? Franny's been burned. It made it sound like, you know, a pot of boiling water had fallen on her foot or something.
Sure.
And he said, oh, by the way, call a priest.
Yeah.
And she lay in agony for a few more hours and then died. Now, the question, this did not come up until years later. It was more or less forgotten and came up years later after the bombing.
Of course.
And people wondered, did he do it? Well, he had the mechanical know-how to do something like this. But did he do it? There's no way to know. His behavior was strange, you know, throwing water on her, you know, saying, oh, Franny's been burned. Can I borrow the phone? Call a priest. There was no sense of urgency.
You said there was a motivation.
Yeah, certainly a motivation.
It was seemingly motivation with the estate. His father was ailing.
Yeah.
Now suddenly has competition with a young bride and a three-year-old sister.
But there's no way to know.
Of course,
in a court of law, it just wouldn't stand up without, you know, something like
that. But circumstantially, retrospectively.
Circumstantially,
certainly.
Could have pulled it off.
Certainly.
He could have set it to go off. We just don't know.
And the what would be deemed psychopathic response in light of the injury next door with the neighbor is, again, some circumstantial, not actual evidence, but certainly a harbinger of things, we'll say it could be.
Yeah, if I were, you know, I won't say that he did it, but if I were off the record, say, and I'm not off the record, but if I were off the record, I'd say, yeah, he did it. But again, no way to know. After that, he eventually makes his way. He reintroduces himself to Nellie Price.
Right.
And they end up getting married and moving to her childhood home in Bath. He buys it. And they, you know, it's a nice three-story home, too. And everybody remembers Nellie from when she was a child because she kind of grew up in that house. Her mother had died and she had been raised by her uncle, who was well-known in the area. He was a politician and a very well-known man in the area.
They had an opportunity to buy the home as a result of her uncle dying. So there was an agreement for him to put a down payment down and then terms of payment.
Right.
They moved to this new 80 acres, this land. What about those payments?
He didn't make them. I mean, that simple. He stopped paying the mortgage. There was, you know, and there were various attempts to get him to pay the mortgage and he just refused. Now, there was no danger of them tossing him out because the family owned the house and he was paying off the mortgage to Nellie's family. So they never would have been kicked out of the house. They never would have foreclosed. And did he know this in the back of his mind that would have happened? I don't know, possibly. But in any event, he just refused to pay his mortgage.
You talk about his character though. And his father was a big influence in terms of his father hated taxation and had an idea that farmers should share in the wealth of their crops by managing them and maybe even holding them back in the market.
Exactly.
So he had some radical ideas. He was a well-known figure in the area. And despite Andrew not starting off in that regard, he seemed to be influenced by his father and picked up some of the same messages and was involved in the same kind of discussions with farmers and these bureaus that cropped up, pun intended, I guess, regarding management of their farms.
Exactly. What both his father and, you know, Andrew Kehoe believed was that the farmer, again, as you say, should control his product. And in doing so, he let his farm go to seed. Pardon the pun on my part, but he let the crops rot. And he thought, you know, his feeling was, why should I grow my crops and sell them when everybody else can sell them? If we stop, if we hold back, we can control our price and we can make more money. It's not a sound way to farm, but that's what was his belief. And he told others that this is what you should do.
Now, you write about this interest in electricity morphs into him being sort of a go-to guy, expert on this new fledgling electricity, but also he was a handyman, and he was also wanting to be involved in the school board.
Right.
So tell us about his involvement in the school board and just his behavior in that regard.
Right. Yeah, now he had one of the most modern farms in the area. He had a steam-powered tractor. And people were, you know, quite fascinated with all these technical things that he had on the farm that nobody else did. And he felt there was nothing crazy about this, though he and Nellie didn't have children. He felt when they were building the new school, well, he paid taxes. And his feeling is that, you know, as a taxpayer, he should have say. And so he ran for the school board. Nothing wrong with that. And he was elected treasurer of the school board. Now, he had a very cantankerous relationship with Emery Hike, who was the superintendent. Mm. And they would often fight back and forth about what things cost. You know, what Andrew didn't want anything that was, you know, he felt was an unreasonable cost. Things that were needed for the school, new desks, new books, art for the walls, playground equipment, stuff like that. Now, I've been in education for a long time, and I've attended many, many school board meetings. There was nothing outlandish about this behavior. Mm-hmm. When friends of mine read the book, they said, well, you must have based their arguments on, you know, this person and that person. I said, well, they certainly helped inform me of you know, there was nothing unusual about that kind of behavior. When things didn't go his way, he would often try to shut down the meetings. He would go to adjourn the meeting. It didn't always work. But that was his feeling. I'm a taxpayer. I should be involved. And he and Emery Hike were just oil and water. And Hike often said, I think this guy is out to get me. He didn't know, of course, how deep he was out to get him, but he felt that Andrew Kehoe was out to get him. Now, Andrew Kehoe, as you know, I've said, was new electricity, was a handyman, excellent repairing things. So because he was a school trustee, they felt, you know, they would save money on, you know, handymen, you know, hiring somebody to fix things. So he was given complete access to the school to fix things. When something broke down, when the generator broke down, they didn't have electricity in Bath at this point. I like to say the Roaring Twenties roared right past Bath.
Right.
It was because they were just getting electricity actually the week of the bombing, and there was a generator, and he would fix the generator. He had a generator on his farm too, one of the few people in town who had an electrical generator. But he would fix that. He would fix the boiler when it was broke. There was an incident where there was a beehive. Apparently, some bees had built a hive next to the furnace. And when it warmed up in the winter, the school was infested with bees. And they tried one thing, and then they tried another thing. And then they said, Andrew, can you do this? And he went down there, and nobody knows what he did. But the bee infestation was gone. He stopped the bees. And interestingly, as an aside, the school's nickname today, the team name, is the Bees. And it was long rumored it was because of what happened with Kehoe finding the bees. But it was not that. It was some kid, his father ran a beehive or something like that. And so he suggested the name the Bees.
When you talk about Kehoe at this time as well, there was some of the work that he would do on his father's farm was blowing up stumps and removing boulders and using dynamite. Further along in this story a little bit, we talk about a New Year's Eve in 1926.
Right. And 26 into 27.
Right. What was the situation in terms of the relationship with Nellie? What was her health like?
Well, Nellie was sick. She was often sick. She was often in and out of the hospital. She had some kind of lung issues. Might have been tuberculosis. But she was thin. She was constantly coughing. She was quiet. And he took care of her. They would, you know, whenever they would attend meetings or something, she would sit next to him, and she was very quiet. She was quite dependent on him. As far as the dynamite, he was the go-to guy in town for dynamite. And it sounds strange, but for the time, there was nothing wrong with it. There would, if you had a stump, an old tree stump in your field or a giant boulder or something, you couldn't have a, you know, your horse drag it out. You'd kill your horse or, you know, you'd wreck your automobile, your truck trying to pull it out. So you would blow it up. And that was a dangerous, you know, proposition. You needed to know exactly how to wire the dynamite and where to stand and all these things. And he had this knowledge. So he was the go-to guy for blowing up stumps. It was known as stump blasting. Today, they use enormous grinders to get out stumps and boulders. But back then, you just blew them up. Standard thing. People came to him all the time. You know, could you blow up a boulder here, blow up one there? Sure, happy to do it. And he would often go to Lansing to pick up more dynamite and pyrrolidone, which was a war surplus, World War I surplus explosive that was also common for the era. On New Year's 26 and 27, at midnight, there was enormous explosion at Kehoe's farm that people heard from miles around. And people, you know, asked, you know, Nellie later, you know, when she was questioned about it, she said, oh, the boy is just having some fun. What I think happened was he set it on a timer. It conceivably was the dress rehearsal. Obviously, what he did took a long time to plan and it required exacting timers within the school. And because he was an electrical expert, you know, he was able to set timers. You know, you want your dynamite to go off at midnight exactly if you're setting off, you know, things to celebrate the new year. So he set them on timers and set it off at, you know, midnight on New Year's. It conceivably was a dress rehearsal for what was going to happen in a few months.
Let's use this as an opportunity, Arnie, to stop for a second and talk about our sponsor, which is Truebill. Do you know why free trials renew without your consent? It's a business scam out to get you. Don't let greedy corporations pocket your money. Download Truebill to take control of your subscriptions. Truebill is the new app that helps you identify and stop paying for the subscriptions you don't need, want, or simply forgot about. On average, people save up to $720 a year with Truebill. Because companies make subscriptions hard to cancel, Truebill makes it incredibly simple. Just link your accounts and Truebill will cancel your unwanted subscriptions in one tap. And your Truebill concierge is there when you need them to cancel unwanted subscriptions so you don't have to. Truebill was easy to sign up for. I just signed up and I've already saved almost $200. I love Truebill and you'll love saving money just like I did. Truebill has over 2 million users and helps save them over $100, 100 million. Like Matthew B, who says, in a matter of seconds, I saved $660 for the year on my DirecTV bill, saved $120 for the year on my Sirius XM bill, and saved $840 a year on car insurance. Don't fall for subscription scams. Start canceling today at truebill.com/truemurder. Go right now. Truebill.com/truemurder. It could save you thousands a year. Now, Ernie, we were talking about this, what you considered a dress rehearsal, New Year's Eve, 1926. And in after New Year's, there was a couple people. You mentioned a guy named Job Slight and another neighbor that realized that he had just blown off these explosives. In fact, the one neighbor was employed basically to go pick up some of these supplies, these explosives in Jackson and in Lansing at different times. What was the, we talk about this school board and he was a treasurer, but he had attempted to make some moves and try to convince other people on that board of the kinds of things that he was interested in, despite having this major dispute with this Superintendent Hike. But in terms of his success with this school board, where was he at in 1926?
He wanted to run for other offices in the area. He just as the peace, a couple other offices. He was briefly appointed to an office when one woman who held the office died. But when he ran for re-election, he didn't win. And so when the election was held at the town hall, and he and his wife, at the town community center. His wife just sat there while it was clearly obvious he was not going to win and didn't say anything about it. But so just went back to doing his duty apparently he had, you know, hopes of achieving some political power in the area, but it just was not meant to be, unfortunately. You know, had he done so, who knows, you know, what would have happened? Could the story be different? Would he be telling the story today? Who knows?
You talked about Nelly's deteriorating health, but also the idea that the Price estate wanted to negotiate some kind of payment plan, and they were having a hard time even trying to get any kind of negotiation with Kehoe. What was the status at that time, and what happened in that period of time that may have affected Kehoe and some of his decisions?
Well, in fact, there was an inheritance that Nelly got, and their attorney, you know, they had applied it to the mortgage, given that there hadn't been any payments made. Now, Andrew Kehoe was furious about this, and he and Nelly went to an attorney and a judge, and, you know, you didn't ask us, you should have done this first. And while it was agreed, yeah, that was a wrong move, and legally it was a wrong move, it would be in the best interest to apply this money to the mortgage, given how much they owed. Kehoe absolutely refused. And even though it was Nellie's money, because the inheritance was to her, he said, no, we're not doing it. And she acquiesced to her husband. And so they got the money, but they didn't apply it to the mortgage. It was just, it seemed like he was spiraling out of control. He couldn't handle his personal life very well. He couldn't get reelected. He was letting his farm rot. He was not paying his mortgage. And there clearly was something going on. On the other hand, he was able to maintain a veneer where people understood that, you know, Andrew was cantankerous and had some very odd things about him. And other times he was a nice guy. The children, in fact, Josephine Cushman, one of the survivors, said to me, he was always nice to us kids, tipped his hat, you know, always, you know, be sure to study kids. And it was always very nice to them.
There was a move by the family, though, to try to persuade him to negotiate. They really hadn't intended to do what this note threatened. So what was the threatening note, and what happened with one of the sisters imploring them not to do it?
Right. Now, the sheriff was going to foreclose, and a foreclosure notice was sent out, and one of the sisters, Nellie's sister, said, no, don't do it. She's in bad health. This really could break her. Please don't do it. And so they tried to stop this foreclosure notice from reaching the Kehoes. But unfortunately, this was a day where communications is not as wonderful and easy and quick as we have it today. And the courier did not get the message. And so he brought the foreclosure notice to Kehoe. Kehoe said, well, if it wasn't for the school, I would have been able to make paid my mortgage. He felt that the school taxes were killing him.
Right.
It was that, it's one of those, you know, in retrospect, you see how his thinking was. But at the time, it was just like, why isn't he paying his mortgage? What is with this guy?
Now, Nelly was in the hospital off and on in Lansing. And so he had gone into Lansing. Her sisters lived in Lansing, three of them. And so tell us what happens with taking her back to the home. And then the phone call from the sisters, finding out about her welfare.
Right. Yeah. And he picked her up from the hospital, and he said he was taking two friends in the area, and that they were going to spend some time with them. And they said, oh, that sounds good. And he says, yeah, we'll talk to you soon. That was the last they heard. They didn't speak to Nelly. That was the last they heard of Nelly, though. And it turned out later that he did not go to those friends' house, because when after the bombing and Kehoe's house was ablaze and Nelly was missing, the sisters called those friends. And they said, no, he never came here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we mentioned one of these friends that had an automobile and he was really a good-natured guy that would give people rides to Lansing, for example, and had done, as I mentioned, some errands where he had picked up some supplies on behalf of Kehoe, and Kehoe said it was regarding the school and repairs. What were some of the things that he was asked to pick up on a couple of these occasions?
Dynamite and blasting caps. Dynamite and blasting caps. And it was, again, Kehoe was the go-to guy for dynamite. It wasn't unusual. Nobody thought anything of it. Although when they were driving back, at that point, Kehoe did not have a car. He got himself a truck, maybe the year before the bombing.
Right.
Can't recall offhand. But when his friend saw he was putting the blasting caps, he said, "You hold those in your lap. We're going to keep the dynamite in the back, and you hold those blasting caps in your lap because one bump, and you know we're blown to kingdom come."
Mm-hmm.
And again, nothing unusual about that. That's the thing. It was also normal. You know, I'm sure people are thinking, "My goodness, all this dynamite!" But yeah, that was the way it was. And if anyone has a farming background, and I've talked to people who've had farming backgrounds, they said, "Yeah, that was how my grandpa did it."
You the story features a janitor named Smith. Smith notices some odd things weeks before and days before. What does he notice? And then take us to that morning and how it is that Kehoe is asked to come to the school.
Right. Well, what Smith had noticed was that there was a trap door in the basement. And it was open, and he swore he had closed it. He couldn't figure out why it was open, so he just closed it up again. And then he noticed that the lock on the basement door was broken. How it was broken, why it would be broken, made no sense. But you know, they had to take it and get it fixed. They couldn't get a locksmith in or something. So those were unusual. Now, he wouldn't have noticed that all the wiring that Kehoe had done. He wouldn't have noticed any of that. He wouldn't think to look for it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a basement. It wasn't well lit or anything like that. It was later, I mean, Kehoe must have been months planning this and setting everything up. It was intricate what he did. And because he had access to the school 24 hours a day and everybody trusted him, there was no reason to think that he was doing, who can, fathom these things?
Certainly.
And so he was spending his nights laying everything out in there. He ended up putting 600 pounds of dynamite and pyrrhotol in that basement. Only 100 pounds went off under the north wing of the school, but also an elaborate electrical system with timers. There was gasoline-soaked rugs for accelerants, things like that, that thankfully did not work. Those were the kinds of things that he was doing all along. Now, that morning, he mailed a package. The package later was, we can go into that later with the package, but it was an old dynamite box, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't think anything of it at the time. And they saw him, they said, "Hey, there's something wrong with the boiler. Could you take a look?" And he went in there and he was kind of agitated.
Right.
And he kept looking at his watch and he said, "You know what? I really don't have the time for this." And he drove off. What's with Andrew this morning? That was maybe 45 minutes or so before the bomb went off.
When the bomb went off, you talk about neighbors seeing, hearing, and then there was the Kehoe farm.
Right.
That wasn't too far away, and there was neighbors and witnesses to that as well. So what was the first thing that was seen, as you do in the book? Tell us.
Right. It was actually, as I say, I think the New Year's Eve event was for the New Year's Eve explosions were just rehearsal. Both the school and the house went off pretty much simultaneously.
Right.
And people didn't know what was going on. It was about 8:30 or so in the morning. And there was just this enormous explosion at the north wing of the school. I mean, it was supposed to be the whole school, but something must have happened. Maybe there was a short or wires got ripped or something, but only the north wing of the school went blue. It rose about 4 to 6 feet in the air, two stories, and then pancaked down on top of itself. People thought maybe the boiler had exploded. The sheriff in the area originally thought that maybe they had been using airplane fuel in the boiler. Right. People were known to do that,
right.
The area. And it was a different era. And at the same time, his farm started, just went ablaze. And there were periodic explosions inside his house. They learned, of course, he had laced it with dynamite and set off explosions, things like that, with electricity. So there were the people who were closer to his farm who thought that the farm was ablaze. And then there were the people by the school the school had exploded. And nobody was connecting the two. Nobody was, what do you mean the school blew up? Kehoe's farm is on fire. What do you mean Kehoe's farm is on fire? The school has just blown up. And people thought it was a mistake, in some cases. And then they realized something really awful was happening in town, as it gradually they understood that these two things were going on simultaneously.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Now, disbelief from everyone. I mean, they heard this explosion. Some people see the inferno that is the farm itself, Kehoe's farm. There's a gunshot heard by a neighbor named Lulu sometime in the morning as well. Tell us what possibly the response is and by who first.
Okay. Yeah, it was Lulu Hart. Was the Harts lived across the street from her. There were a lot of people named Hart in town. Everybody, it kind of drove me crazy because there were Harts with an E at the end and Harts without an E at the end. And they were all branches of the same family. And that is Bath. There's, you know, people who have lived there for generations. And, you know, she saw his farm was ablaze. And her first reaction was, he must have done it. She said, don't go over there. He said it. He must have said it himself.
Yeah.
Now, being a farm community, they set off a bucket brigade trying to, you know, stop the blaze. Meanwhile, the Hart farm, there was, you know, there were embers and they were afraid that the farm was going to go, you know, that the barn would set on fire.
Right.
Fortunately, there had been a rain the night before. So there was like a light layer of dew on top of the barn roof, and that stopped the embers from catching fire. Meanwhile, you know, people are coming to Kehoe's, and to say it was on fire is to put it mildly. It was an inferno. It was just thick with smoke, and there was periodic booms from the dynamite he had inside the house. And people gathered at the sides saw his truck was disappeared into a cloud of smoke, and then came out, and he looked at them and he said, "Boys, you're friends of mine. You better get out of here. You better go down to the school." And they were confused. What is going on here?
Right.
And Kehoe started driving in the direction of the school.
Now, you have this incredible scene where the superintendent, Hike, is helping people. He's up on a roof at one point and telling people not to jump off, wait for the ladder. So he's involved in this desperate rescue mission. And then Kehoe arrives with his flatbed truck and they meet, their eyes meet, and he calls him over to the vehicle.
Yeah.
Tell us, describe this scene as you do in the book.
Now Kehoe pulled up, you know, I mean, Superintendent Hike was pretty much the marshaling the rescue effort, as well as participating in it, dragging kids out, you know, taking them to safety, going back. He was telling high school boys not to jump out the window, and they jumped anyway. They didn't want to listen to him that day, and it was probably a good thing. When Kehoe pulled up, he was like driving out like a bat out of hell. And in fact, a couple of people had to jump out of the way so they wouldn't get hit by his truck. He pulled up, and as much as he hated Kehoe, said, you know, he went up. He said, it was old fashioned truck. He put his foot on the running board, and he put his hand on the window. The window was rolled down and on the passenger side. And he said, "We need your help. We need you to get ropes. We need to get ladders. We need to use your truck that way." And Kehoe looked at him and said, "Okay, I'll take you with me." And something clicked in Hike's mind. And he said, "You know something about this, don't you?" Now, this story was told to me by one of the survivors. His sisters had seen this and seen the entire exchange that happened. So this is what happened, according to their eyewitness account. And there was an immense explosion. Kehoe had packed the truck with a dynamite, and he fired a gun into the charge of dynamite. It blew up the truck, blew himself up, blew Hike up. He had packed the truck with nails and rusty cans, things like that. It was shrapnel. It just spread out and killed a couple more people, and injured many more. Now, one of the people I interviewed, Myrna Gates, she was a freshman in high school at the time. She was one of the new interviews I did. She was holding a trachea on a victim, a young child named Helen Kamm, I believe. And it's what she told me was more or less confirmed all that. Not that I, you know, it was from her perspective. Now, there was a nurse there and by the name of Crum, and her husband was the local doctor and pharmacist. And so she was helping with the rescue effort. And this girl, Helen Kamm, couldn't breathe. So they had to put a trachea in her. Now, there wasn't time to get anything, you know, like a tube or anything like that. So what Mrs. Crum did was crack open a ballpoint pen.
Yeah.
And she took, you know, 14-year-old Myrna and said, "Okay, here's what you do. Here's how you hold the, you know," is that not, you know,
incredible
simple direction. It was just like quick and dirty. "Here's what you got to do. Hold it so she can breathe."
Yeah.
And so Myrna was holding this trachea so this poor girl could breathe and stay alive. And Myrna told me she heard this enormous scream It was just ghastly. And that's and an enormous flash and boom. So, you know, that was when Hike and, you know, confronted Keo and realized what was going on. It was probably the scream and then the explosion.
Yeah. And you write, again, not to be purposely graphic, but they looked for Keo's body and found, as you write, a clump.
Yeah.
And with the proof, well, or the proof of who that person, that clump was, were two documents. What were those documents?
I believe one was his driver's license, and I can't recall what the other one was off the top of my head. But also his face was more or less intact, and he was visually identified by someone too.
Oh, okay.
But certainly the driver's license, the other document confirmed that it was Kehoe, but you could tell that it was Andrew Kehoe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't want to get grisly, and I certainly had to for the book, but
yeah,
you know, it was a grisly scene. There's no, you know, dancing around that.
This is out of order, but they searched Kehoe Farm and found some dynamite, but who else did they find there?
They found the remains of Nellie. Now, nobody knew where, you know, there was a massive search for Nellie. The sisters were terrified and were calling around, and there was this massive search for Nellie. Nobody could find her. The next day, a couple of Michigan state police who were guarding the place, more or less, decided to take a smoke break and, you know, went for a cigarette out back, and they saw this cart that people had been walking back and forth and back and forth. And there it was in plain sight was this cart with a box on it. And inside were the remains of Nellie Kehoe, you know, burned beyond recognition. And it was a gruesome sight, to be sure. And the skull was cracked. Now, was it cracked because Kehoe bludgeoned her? Or there's also, it could have cracked because of, you know, the fire as well. There's no way to know. Did he kill her? We don't know.
Likely.
I mean, he could have cracked her head and he could have strangled her, or she just could have died on him. We don't know. Or he could have just put her there alive and, you know, she could have burned to death for all we know. We just don't know. But on either side of her was a couple of strong boxes. One had like the family silverware and another had money and war bonds. And a significant amount, which probably could have, you know, just sitting there in the house, could have gone for the mortgage. It was a considerable amount of money. Some of it was burned, of course. It was a terrible thing.
We didn't talk about this, and it's hard to even capture speaking about it, but this explosion took down this north wall, as you say, a part of the school, just a part of the school, luckily.
Right.
But so many people were trapped, so many children were trapped under. And so there was a mad dash to try to lift up this wall somehow. They tried ropes. They tried the pry bar type scenario.
Right.
But they went through the rubble, parents, police. They called Lansing authorities and police and firefighters. Right. And people came to try to rescue children that were still in the rubble.
Yes.
And they were finding that there was a fear that there was still dynamite and still active
yeah.
in there.
Yeah.
But you also write about another phenomena. While the ambulances were pouring in and while the volunteers to help were pouring in, there was somebody, another group pouring in as well, causing trouble on the roadways.
Yeah, it was awful. It was, you know, for lack of a better word, tourists, gawkers, ghouls, what have you. And they really came in to see what was going on, and they came for days on end. And in fact, when they were holding funerals in the days that followed, people could not get around town to go to funerals. There was a couple of sisters who were known to sing at funerals. They had to basically jump on the back of a motorcycle that a cop would drive them place to place. Some funerals were held in houses. You could not hear the service because there were so many people. Now, Bath essentially looks like it did in the 1920s. A lot of the same buildings are still there. It doesn't have a stoplight. It's the quintessential small town America. There's still no stoplight in downtown Bath. It's a four-way stop sign. And I can't, you know, if you have 10 cars in Bath, it's a traffic jam. I cannot imagine 50,000 people descending into town. And this is before the interstate. It was unbelievable how many people came in. And some of them were really crude about it too. There was, you know, one woman, you know, you know, yell out of her car, "Hey, where's the cemetery? I want to see it." And the woman that she called said, "It's that way. I'm burying two of my children there tomorrow." In another case, somebody just walked up to a door and said, "I want to see the dead body." It's awful people. And while Kehoe's truck was sitting there, you know, before everything was cleared away on that morning, the morning of the explosion, after he'd blown himself up, somebody came in, snipped off a piece of intestine that was lodged in the wheel, threw it in a jar and ran off with a souvenir, I guess you could call it.
Mm-hmm.
Ghoulish. Now, what's interesting to me, and people would scoop up, you know, dirt from the farm and take bricks and things like that for, you know, souvenirs. I mean, it sounds really awful, but in another case where children were killed, I had friends who grew up in the area where John Gacy killed those boys, and told me that when his house was torn down, people came by with mason jars and were scooping up dirt. So yeah. There's some...
It's not new.
No, it's not, unfortunately. Some strange... And today you can sell it on eBay too, which is really awful. But that element existed then and it exists now. I don't understand it myself. But it was packed. It was a terrible, terrible thing. People could not mourn properly because of all these people who were coming into town.
You spoke to it, the Josephine Cushman Vale.
Right. It was Josephine Cushman at the time. Later married Claude Vale.
And her younger brother, Ralph.
Yeah, was killed.
And her story is, you weave her story all the way through and right to the end.
Right.
It was more profound just because of all the loss that she experienced, her family experienced. Just tell us a little bit about her story and their loss, their family loss.
Yeah. I will say this right up front. I adored Josephine. I fell in love with her and we had a mutual admiration society. We got to be really close as a result of all this. I interviewed her twice and she was telling me she was in her mid 90s at the time. And she was telling me these really graphic things about what her brother looked like when they found him with his, you know, half his chin was gone and, you know, his body was just riddled with metal and things like that. And, you know, I felt terrible. I said, "Josephine, you don't have to tell me this stuff. I mean, you know, it would be the book's loss, but, you know, I mean, what's that compared to, not causing, you know, undue grief to, a woman who's at the end of her life." And she said to me, "No, I want people to know what happened." And God bless her. She told me exactly what happened. Her mother saw a dog playing with something. She thought it was a glove. And she said, "No, Mom, that's a hand." Josephine saw the worst of the worst that day. And she felt this terrible pain. She was one of the people hit by shrapnel too. And she had a really bad pain in her leg, but she didn't tell her parents because they were going through enough. They kept saying this, parents were going up and down. "Have you seen this kid? Have you seen that kid? You know, have you seen Ralph?" And they said, "Well, we saw Ralph, but he got out." But that was probably Ralph Witchell, who I ended up interviewing after the book came out, as I said. And eventually they found her. And she, that night, she, you know, when they finally went home, and Ralph was dead, they finally went home and they all got in the same bed together. And Josephine said to me that she realized at that moment, she's 14, that her childhood was over. It was gone. And at one point she developed a terrible itch. She never told her parents about it, but she doesn't know what happened, but it was that day she got this awful itch that she couldn't, you know, that was really agonizing, but she didn't say anything to her parents about it. You know, what it was, who knows? It could have been psychosomatic for all we know, physical response to the trauma that she was going through, because she certainly went through a share of trauma. And she was a very special woman and very, it's funny. I saw her. I mean, I would go up to Bath every year for the annual luncheon. And one day I was there and she looked at me and she said, "I'm going to live to be 100. And she did. And she died about 6 weeks after she hit her 100th birthday, but God bless her. She made it to 100. Wonderful lady and very upfront about what happened. She wanted people to know. She felt it was really important to bear witness. And at the end of the book, the way the book closes is it was the 80th commemoration of the bombing. And which was at what had happened about 6 weeks beforehand was the shooting at Virginia Tech. So it was weighing on her mind much more that year than other years. And she would always leave tulips for her at her brother's grave. Now, there had been a tulip in front of the house that Ralph had always wanted. He kept saying to his mother every morning, I have that tulip. And she said, no, we have to let it grow there. And after he was killed, she said, you know what, let Ralph have his tulip. And they put the tulip in the coffin with him. And so every year, Josephine would bring out red tulips to his grave every year for 80 years. And it's a tradition that she was worried that nobody would, that the tradition would die out with her, but family and friends every year bring red tulips to Ralph's grave as long as, and I do it myself. I mean, there's just, you know, I owe her that much. And, you know, it was a beautiful thing. I mean, she never forgot her brother.
You say that, and you give thanks to many people like young Alan. Sorry, I can't remember her first name, but you say she was instrumental in getting her father.
Michelle Allen. Yes.
Michelle Allen.
My angel.
Yes.
Yeah. She's one of the museum people. And she's actually the person I called the morning of Sandy Hook too. Lovely, lovely person. When I interviewed her dad was in early stages of Alzheimer's. And he couldn't remember what, you know, he had for breakfast, you know, let alone where he was. Mm. But when we talked about that day, you know, we had to kind of tease it out of him, but he knew, you know, he knew exactly what had happened. You know, we'd approach him this way, that way to get the story, but he knew, he didn't forget. And his brother had been killed. And his brother was apparently quite a good ball player and he was convinced that had his brother not killed, he would have made it to the majors.
Yeah.
In fact, when I mentioned the two eyewitnesses who saw the confrontation between Kehoe and Hike, that was actually Harold Burnett's sisters.
Interesting.
So he told me that story too. So, you don't forget things like this. I mean, Alzheimer's is a terrible thing, but something like this is indelible.
Mm-hmm. Tell us just a little bit briefly about the Bath Consolidated School Museum.
And you say
that they're the caretaker of memory.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the museum.
Well, the school itself, most of it remained standing. You know, only the north wing was really destroyed. So they rebuilt the school, and the school stayed in what was, you know, it was used up until the 1970s. So it lasted about 50, 60 years. When it was torn down, outlived its usefulness. It was built in the mid 20s, and by the late 70s, it wasn't safe to even be in the school. It was outmoded and, you know, other things. So they decided to tear it down. And this was a controversial thing to tear down that school. It was like tearing down a cathedral. But they did it. And there was a lot of anger about it too. Some people thought it should be turned to a nursing home or a library or something like that. But instead what they did was they took the space that was the school, and it's been turned into a memorial park, Cousins Memorial Park, named after Senator Cousins, who helped finance the rebuilding of the school.
Right.
And they kept the cupola that was on top of the school, the original school. They put it in the center of the park at roughly the same geographical space it would have been. And it's really a contemplative place. There's bricks lining the cupola with names of the victims. And there's a Michigan State historical marker at the end of the edge of the park. And the Methodist church that was actually there on the day of, the principal was actually in the Methodist church rehearsing kids for graduation ceremonies at the time of the bombing. The Methodist church is still there. And there's posts, cement posts. You can see posts from the old school foundation poking through the lawn. But the new school was built, and they decided to dedicate a wing of it to what happened that day. They didn't want to forget. And they created the Bath School Museum. It has a lot of artifacts of the day. There's the clock that is frozen in time at the time the bomb went off. The flag that was flying over the school that day. Pictures of, you know, the school, of what it looked like, of the also the Kehoes in there. They don't hide anything. They don't hide who he was or what happened. And it's quite a place. Pictures of various graduating classes, things like that. Pictures of victims. There's I don't know what you would call it, but there's like these giant hanging frames with articles, news articles, and with reminiscences by survivors, things like that. And they also have, there's also something called the Girl with the Cat, which was a memorial statue that was made. It was money was raised for it by children throughout Michigan, sending pennies. And it's a girl with a holding a cat. That's why it's called Girl with a Cat. And it just represents hope and the children who were lost. And for years, it stood in the foyer of the old school. And now it's in a case inside the school museum. And they also have other things. It's not just the bombing. They have like various classes, you know, football, you know, they had examples of like band uniforms, things like that. They have what I got a big kick out of. They had the old, you know, Dick and Jane readers, which is how I learned to read, believe it or not. And they had those in the museum too, which I got an enormous kick out of that. So it's kind of a museum of Bath schools as well as what happened that day. And it's quite a place.
Now, before I let you go, you mentioned a person named Matt Martin.
Yes.
And a documentary project. Can you tell us about this?
Yeah, Matt and I have known each other a long time. I started the book in 2005, and at the same time, he's a Lansing-based filmmaker. He was starting a documentary on it. And he and I we've shared interviews, we've shared information over the years. We've gotten to be good friends as well. And he's close to finishing this film. It's called Forgotten. It's going to be a multi-part documentary. It's got interviews with survivors' children and grandchildren, experts, including myself. And it's going to be released. Not sure when. And I've seen parts of it. It's wonderful. It has recreations and the interviews. Really beautifully put together, really reverent and honoring the children who died. And at the end of the day, that's what matters. And that's what I hope, you know, I got across in my book. This isn't about anything else but kids who were killed. And that's the important thing to remember. And that's why at the end of my book, I include the list of names of all the children who died and the adults as well who were killed. That's the most important thing I want people to, you know, take away from this. These aren't just, you know, puppets from history, figures from history. These were real people. These were real kids who were really killed. And what we see today at things like Sandy Hook or Columbine or Marjory Stoneman, it happened in Bath. And, you know, you can't forget that. It's, you know, the persistence of memory is what keeps these kids alive.
Absolutely. I want to thank you very much, Arnie Bernstein, for coming on and talking about Bath Massacre, the new edition, America's first school bombing. For people that might want to take a look at this, is there a Facebook page or a website?
Yeah, well, there's my website. I have information. It's www.arniebernstein.com, all one word. And there is a Facebook page for the book as well. So if you just, you know, go to Facebook and type up Bath Massacre or you Google it or whatever, it's easy to find. And I'm always happy to talk to people if they want to email me either through email or Facebook, through my webpage. Happy to talk to people.
Great. Thank you so much, Arnie Bernstein.
Yes.
Bath Massacre, the new edition, America's first school bombing.
Thanks for having me again, Dan. I'm always happy to tell this story.
Thank you so much. You have a great night.
You too. Good night. Take care.